All right, so bear with me for a second. I'm going to ask a question, and on the count of three, I want y'all to give me the answer all together, all right? What book or letter comes before 2 Corinthians? 1, 2, 3. Okay, we've just established that everybody in here knows how to speak up in a class setting. So please, during this 3 months, it will help me a lot if y'all would speak up during this class setting. Otherwise, we're going to cover 3 months worth of material in about a month and a half. Because we all know that I don't talk very fast. So just something to think about. Also, another thing that I wanted to discuss with y'all. There are a lot of people in here with a vast amount of Bible knowledge. And as such, there will be questions at times. I'm confident that I won't be able to answer. So I'm going to rely on some lifelines. One of those being is ask an elder and get their view or their thoughts on a question. Or ask the audience and get their views or thoughts on a question, trying to help determine what the scriptures are saying, because I do understand that there are going to be things that I may not be able to answer. And then third, we'll just have that imaginary I don't know bucket over here that we can put those questions in for later on where I can study and I can answer them for you. So just wanted to let y'all know that that is definitely going to be the case. Now, we're going to be studying 2 Corinthians. If you look at your class schedule, you'll see how we've kind of laid it out. We'll start today with background and review, Wednesday introduction, and you have that material. Background and review, all you needed for this morning. I felt like it'd be a little bit better to do just to have a map, and we'll just kind of, I'll ask questions, we'll go through and discuss this, because this is going to be something that I think you'll have a basic knowledge of. I'll put out the first actual 2 Corinthians lesson for chapter 1. We'll put it out tonight, so if you would pick that up. There will be markings, so try to get it ahead of time. Go through and work through the markings. It helped me tremendously in my studies, and I hope it helps you as well. So as we start a study of 2 Corinthians, where would be a good place to start studying this letter?
Acts.
Why Acts? All right, that's when he went to Corinth. First, I want you to look over at Luke chapter 1. As we all know, Luke was the author of Acts. Luke chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of these things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us by those from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, it seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out for you in a consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the exact truth about the things you have been taught." In Luke's gospel, he started with Christ, the good news. And then after Christ went to heaven is where Acts picks up. And so Luke, as a physician, was very detailed in his accounts, included a lot of information so that we can test today what was said. It was a lot of the things he included were very specific, so we have an understanding that these things were true. All right. Acts chapter 15 is where Paul starts his second missionary journey. Who traveled with Paul on his second missionary journey?
Barnabas.
All right. What it in the end of chapter 15, it says that Paul kept insisting that they should not take him, meaning John Mark. Well, we'll start in verse 37 of Acts 15. Barnabas wanted to take John Mark along with them, but Paul kept insisting they should not take him because he had deserted them. And so he skipped down to verse 40. It says he chose Silas. So Silas was his traveling companion. You get over to Acts chapter 18, and this is where Paul first visited Corinth. chapter 18, verse 1, after these things, he left Athens and went to Corinth. Time period. Does anybody know what time period this may have been? 50. I have in my notes 51 to 53. I know that there will be some variances in dates. John, how did you come up with that date?
Got it wrong.
I think you might have gone through some of the study of Acts or 1st and 2nd Corinthians before. Okay, so there are some anchor points in Acts that you can use to establish dates. One being Herod's death in Acts chapter 12. That was Herod, that's the one who got eaten by worms. Galileo, who was a proconsul in Achaia, that's here in chapter 18. And Festus, who was the procurator in Acts chapter 24, and that was around 60 AD. So you've got Herod, who died in around 44 AD, Galileo around 51, 52, and then you've got Festus around 60 AD. We'll get into a timeline in a little bit. How long was Paul in Corinth at this time before he left? About a year and a half, that's correct. Actually, it was a year and a half, chapter 18, verse 11, and then it says many days longer in verse 18 of chapter 18. What was the makeup of that congregation?
Gentiles.
Just Gentiles or?
Jews as well.
Jews and Gentiles. So it was a mixed congregation. You had those who had been idol worshippers or had not had any sort of background in who Jesus was or the Israelites or anything like that. And then you had Jews who ascribed to the old law still. Who met Paul in Corinth? Silas and Timothy. So Paul had gone on ahead. Silas and Timothy came and met him. These will be people who Timothy especially, we'll see later on in 2 Corinthians. We just want to kind of establish who was there when the church was established in Corinth. All right, the political landscape of the time. Can anybody give me an idea of what was going on during this time period in history? Who was in power? Rome. It was a Roman dictatorship. It was divided down into proconsuls or provincial governors, basically governor of each area. And there was also local authority who received complaints in courts and they could judge on them. But what also was going on in regards to the Jews? Well, they had to answer to Rome, but they still had the old law in place. They still had their own theocracy in place. They were still ascribing to the old law. If you look over at Acts chapter 18, starting in verse 12, we can kind of see how this setup was. But while Galileo was the proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat, saying, "This man persuaded men to worship God contrary to the law." But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Galileo said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrong or vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. But if there were any questions about words and names and your own law, look at it yourselves. I am unwilling to be a judge of these matters." And he drove them away from the judgment seat. And they all took hold of Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue, and began beating him in front of the judgment seat. But Galileo was not concerned about any of these things. So they were under a Roman dictatorship, but the Jews were still ascribing to their old theocracy, the old law. All right, who was the leader of the synagogue at the time? Verse 17. Sosthenes. Do we read about him anywhere else? And this is just to test your Bible knowledge. This is not meant to make anybody feel inadequate about this. I wouldn't have been able to answer these questions either, but just trying to draw some questions out, some interactivity in the class.
1 Corinthians chapter 1.
1 Corinthians chapter 1. You'll turn over to there. First Corinthians chapter 1, Paul called as an apostle of Jesus Christ by the will of God, and Sosthenes our brother. If you look over at verse 14 of chapter 1, it says, I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius. Now, I have in my notes, I don't know that I could ever actually pinpoint exactly, but Acts 18:8 also mentions Crispus. Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all his household. I couldn't actually pinpoint that these were the same people, but it is thought that they could be the same people. Crispus, also known as Sosthenes, and you see them both in Acts and in 1 Corinthians. All right, so Acts chapter 18, verse 23, Paul starts his third missionary journey. In verse 24 through 27, we read that Apollos was converted and traveled to Corinth to preach and teach. And then starting in chapter 19, they arrive at Ephesus. So what happened in Ephesus? There's a lot of different answers to this question. There's
Demetrius.
There was a riot. That's right. There was a Demetrius the silversmith kind of incited a riot. Before that, why he incited the riot was Paul had come and he started preaching and teaching Christ, and he started converting people. And if you look at over at chapter 19, verse 23, it said, about that time there occurred no small disturbance concerning the way, for a man named Demetrius, the silversmith, who made silver shrines to Artemis, was bringing no little business to the craftsmen. These had gathered together with the workmen of similar trades and said, men, you know that our prosperity depends upon this business. You see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned a considerable number of people, saying that gods made with hands are no gods at all. Not only is there a danger that this trade of ours falls into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis be regarded as worthless, and that she whom all Asia and the world worship will even be dethroned from her magnificence. To me, it's amazing and encouraging to see that Paul was having such an impact, not only here, but throughout that region. So much so that this guy felt he was getting his feelings hurt. He was losing money. He was making these idols for worship, and Paul was definitely getting into his pocket, and so he incited a riot against them. In verse 29, they dragged Gaius and Aristarchus into the theater. Paul wanted to go to the assembly, but the disciples wouldn't let him. And because of all this, he wound up leaving and heading into Macedonia and then into Greece. Let's look at chapter 20. This is going to be where 2 Corinthians kind of the second trip to Corinth kind of falls into play. So chapter 20, verse 1. After the uproar had ceased, Paul sent from the disciples, and when he had exhorted them and taken his leave of them, he left to go to Macedonia. And when he had gone through those districts and had given them much exhortation, he came to Greece. And there he spent 3 months, and when a plot was formed against him by the Jews, as he was about to sail from Syria, he decided to return through Macedonia. Macedonia, what were some congregations or some cities in that region that we might know of?
Thessalonica.
Philippi. I'll have one more, so. I have Berea as well. But they can be categorized as Macedonia. That is a region, if you look at your map, we have a map because of this. You can kind of see that it's at the top of Greece. Do you see where I've put Philippi and Berea? In that general area is where Macedonia is. I'm a visual person, so it helps me to see this laid out on paper. Now, Paul in verse 2, he said he came to Greece. He spent 3 months there, and then he returned to Macedonia, and then from there, he wound up making his way back to Jerusalem. All right, so time periods. We want to kind of understand. We know when the Corinthian church was established. So we want to kind of figure out when 2 Corinthians was written. All right, so if we look at the fact that he was there between 51 and 53 AD and work forward, if you'll go back to Acts chapter 18, Paul, having remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria. So he's sailing back to Antioch. Now, in that time, you don't sail over the winter months. So he's traveling either spring, summer, or fall. So that would put him back in Antioch, probably spring, summer, or fall of 53 A.D. And then if you go to verse 23, it says, having spent some time there, he left and passed successfully to the Galatian region. So it's supposed that he might have spent the winter in Antioch before he started his travels on his third missionary journey. So, looking at the timeline, that would put him leaving Antioch around spring of 54 A.D. Now, as we get into this, this will be a little bit more historical. You may ask, why does this pertain to what we're studying? What we want to do is and we'll do this in our next class as well, ascertain Paul's trip and the time frame, not only to confirm the validity of the letter, but so we can kind of understand what's going on at the time as Paul writes his letter, because there'll be some things that come up. And so that's why we want to kind of figure out what the dates are. Does 2 Corinthians fall in line as we study? Does it fall in line with what Acts was talking about? Does it fall in line with these anchor points that we have from secular history? And so that's what we're trying to do, is trying to make sure that what we are studying is inspired, and it does line up with what other inspired books that we have. So if he left on his third missionary journey in the spring of 54 A.D. And traveled into the Galatian region and the regions of Asia, we would suppose that he arrives in Ephesus around the fall of 54 A.D. That's Acts chapter 19, verse 1. Let me have my notes right. Yes, that's right. All right. How long was he in Ephesus?
Verse 10 says 2 years, and then it says yet 3 months in verse 8 to your timeline.
All right. Exactly 2 years, 3 months? I know that's a loaded question.
And he says Asia for a while in verse 22.
Verse 22, he himself stayed in Asia for a little while. So we would suppose that Paul was in Ephesus for at least 2 years, 3 months, probably a little bit longer. All right, so we were at the fall of 54 A.D. when Paul arrived in Ephesus. So two years, 3 months later, that would put us at the summer of 57 A.D. Now, where was the First Corinthian letter written? In Ephesus, all right. Do you remember that, or do you know where it was? Why? How do you know that? I guess that'll be a question. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. Verse 8, it says, "But I will remain in Ephesus until Pentecost." Now, as far as I can tell, and we'll see as this goes through, I don't think Paul had visited Ephesus before, so this would fall right in line with Paul's trip to Ephesus in Acts, that he is writing this letter he's writing the letter of 1 Corinthians in Ephesus. And you'll see as we go through how we can kind of determine and solidify that thought.
He all right. Briefly came to Ephesus at the end of the second journey, Acts 18:19.
Yes, sir. All right, thank you. I did some looking, but I overlooked that. All right, so he's in Ephesus, and then from Ephesus, he writes 1 Corinthians to the Ephesians. He writes 1 Corinthians to the Corinthians. You also notice, and this will help us with our time frame, 1 Corinthians 16:8, when he says, "I'll remain in Ephesus till Pentecost." When was Pentecost? Sir?
Springtime.
I have in my notes May to June, and that's something I didn't know before I started studying this. That's kind of a good indicator of when he was there, when he was writing, or when he would stay in Ephesus. So, Acts 20, verse 1 and 2, Paul traveled through Macedonia after he leaves Ephesus. So we assume that would be the AD 57. And that would be probably summer to fall. And then he spends 3 months in Corinth, Acts 20, verse 3, which we're going to presume is the winter of 57 A.D. Now, Paul does say in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 6, "And perhaps I will stay with you or even spend the winter so that you may send me on my way wherever I may go." So he does mention there that his intent was to stay there in the winter. And so from our timeline, it appears that is the case, being there 3 months and not traveling during the winter months. All right, Acts chapter 20, we're going to go back, kind of look at our timeline here of Paul's journey. It says in verse 3, after the three months when a plot was formed against him by the Jews, he decided to return through Macedonia, and then he was making his way back to Jerusalem. What was he trying to make his way back to Jerusalem for? Or what event was he trying to make? Pentecost. So that would put him leaving Corinth around spring of 58 A.D., and that would put him back traveling to Jerusalem, trying to get back for that May, June, that springtime. We'll call it a festival, but for Pentecost. All right, so if we want to work backwards, if you look over at chapter 24 of Acts, just trying to give us a timeline using our anchor points to decide when this book was written and what was going on. Acts chapter 24, verse 27. "But after 2 years he passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison." So one of our anchor points was Festus as procurator around 60 A.D. And if Paul had been in prison 2 years, this kind of backs up to the idea that Paul was in Jerusalem in the summer of 58 A.D., and that was when he was arrested. So just trying to mesh our missionary journeys and the letters that were written, we can kind of see how they would fall in line together. And that's kind of what we wanted to do. Do these letters fall in line with what Luke wrote? We know that Luke was a physician. He was very detailed in what he wrote. And that was his purpose, to give detail, just to give an accurate recollection of what was going on using eyewitnesses and whatnot. And this is how we can use his information. It does align with secular history, and we want to make sure that these letters line up as well, so that we can have confidence in them. All right. So, 1 Corinthians. Where's Doug? Doug should know all about 1 Corinthians. He taught it not too long. Well, I'll say not too long ago, about a year ago. 1 Corinthians. What was Paul's first letter about? What did it include? Give me some things that were going on.
Well, the Corinthians said their overriding problem was misplaced faith.
Yes, sir.
They were putting their faith in men rather than in Jesus and his apostles' teaching. So in that, they got their priorities misfocused. And that affected the way they treated each other, the way they treated the gospel of Christ.
Look at 1 Corinthians. We'll look at some of the language that Paul used when writing this book to support Doug's point. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 21, it says, "For since in the wisdom of God the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to the saved, those who believe. For indeed Jews ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block and to Gentiles foolishness." And he's using some sarcasm here. He's saying God's word is foolish. That's the way they viewed it, man did. Verse 25, "Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than man." And you can kind of see what Doug's talking about here. They were putting their faith in what man said as opposed to what God said. And God's foolishness is so much wiser than man. His weaknesses are so much stronger than man. He was trying to make them see that. What else was going on? Better question. How did Paul know that that was going on?
They sent him
letters. Okay, who sent him a letter?
They sent him two letters.
The Corinthians.
House of Chloe.
Okay, the house of Chloe, and then the Corinthians sent him a letter. From chapter 7 on is the letter that the Corinthians sent him, but from what he's addressing in the first six chapters of this book pertains to verse 11 of chapter 1. For I have been informed concerning you, my brethren, by Chloe's people, that there were quarrels among you. And then he addresses some things. Going into chapter 5, he even says, it is actually reported that there is immorality among you. So he is addressing some things that Chloe had presented to him. So chapters 1 through 4, I have in my notes that it was about the words of man versus God. What does chapter 5 discuss?
Immorality.
Specifically, Alex, do you have any idea of what he was talking to him about?
Man sleeping with his father's wife.
That's right. So he is discussing this situation that they've allowed to happen. And we'll see that he addresses it again in the second Corinthian letter. What about chapter 6?
I've got...
suing and lawsuits. He's discussing these things that they're allowing to happen. They make a congregation made up of Jews and Gentiles, and they're allowing this stuff to creep in. They're allowing man's influence and their backbiting and their differences. They're allowing it to creep in and to affect the way that they treat each other and the fact that they worship God. And so Paul, having been informed by Chloe, is addressing these things. Now, as of the first six chapters, do you think this was easy for them to hear? I mean, anybody like getting in trouble? I don't like getting in trouble. Melissa gets on to me all the time. I can say that because she's not in here. No, nobody. I mean, and from Paul's perspective, how do you think Paul felt when he wrote this letter?
Disappointed.
He was disappointed. He was sorrowful. I mean, it's not something that you want to do. This congregation, this group of people that you spent time with. A group of people that you have this affection towards, that you have a love for, you see these things going on, and then you've got to correct the situation because that's what's right. That was, you know, Paul is trying to lead them in the ways of Christ, and it's sad to see this happen. You don't like to discipline your children, but you do it because you love them. Doesn't mean you're happy about it. I can understand that now as a parent. Never understood that as a kid, but you know it is difficult, and so it was. Paul was disappointed. It was sorrowful to do it, but it's what he needed to do. He needed to address some situations so that they could be corrected. Now, going into chapter 7, chapter 7, verse 1. We'll just read it. Now, concerning the things about which you wrote. So, obviously, he's received a report, and then now he's going to address a letter that they wrote to him. So, the remaining chapters of the book, I mean, of the letter, what does he address?
Seems to be like questions, answering questions. Or
yes, sir.
Issues.
All right. What issues does he discuss?
Marriage, divorce, marriage, widows, wives, and the unmarried.
All right. He discusses marriages and relationships. Look at verse 26. Kind of in this context is what he addresses. I think then, and this is 1 Corinthians 7, verse 26, I think then that this is good in view of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. So he's addressing questions they've asked, but obviously they're going through a current or a present distress, and he's trying to frame what he's talking to them about as to the distress that they're facing. Chapters 8 and 9, what is he talking about? I think I have the meat sacrifice to idols in chapter 10. I think in chapters 8 through 9, he's kind of discussing his liberties, the liberties that he has. Now I'm sorry, they do talk about meat sacrifice to idols in chapter 9 as well. But chapter 11, what do we get into?
Tradition.
What else? The Lord's Supper. So what was going on in as Paul discusses, what did we get from what he's telling them? What was going on? They had turned the Lord's Supper into a common meal. All right. So we also read in verse 19 of 1 Corinthians chapter 11 that for there must be factions among you so that those who are approved may become evident among you. Therefore, when you meet together, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. So they had split into factions. This congregation was made up not only of Jews and Gentiles, but of a higher economic and lower economic group of people. And they had kind of decided, they had started to split. They had formed factions among themselves, and then they'd made the Lord's Supper a common meal. And so what does he discuss in the latter part of chapter 11? Yes, he discusses what's the Lord's Supper for? It is to remember Christ. Right? It is a memorial to him. And verse 28, a man must examine himself in doing so. This isn't some common meal that we should observe flippantly. We should just eat regular food. This is a memorial to remember Christ, our Savior, who died on that cross. It is an important thing. He does clarify here, a man must examine himself. This is a singular thing. We may do it together. And it edifies us, but I am being examined on what I'm doing just as much as everybody else is themselves. Moving into chapter 12 through 14, what does it pertain to?
Spiritual gifts.
All right. Anybody give me some ideas on what was going on with the spiritual gifts? Exactly right. He discusses with them the fact that you can't be edified if somebody's going to speak in tongues but there's not an interpreter. And some other things that were going on. In chapter 12 as well, not only is he discussing maybe the order, but he's also discussing that these gifts are for the common good. They all come from the same place. There is no hierarchy in the sense of I'm better than you because I have a spiritual gift and you don't, or you have a different one. You can kind of see this in chapter 12, starting in verse 4. Now, there are a variety of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are varieties of ministries and the same Lord. There are varieties of efforts, but the same God. Verse 7, but each one is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. Verse 8, knowledge according to the same Spirit. Verse 9, the same Spirit. Gifts of healing by the one Spirit. He's telling them that, look, this is you all have gifts, but there is no hierarchy. It all comes from one place. It's for the common good. And so from there, he discusses these spiritual gifts, how to use them, and kind of lays that out for them. Chapter 15. The resurrection, the belief in the resurrection is what I've got. If we look at, let's see. 15 verse 12. Now if Christ is preached that he has been raised from the dead, how do some among you say that there is no resurrection of the dead? But if there is no resurrection of the dead, not even Christ has been raised. And you can just look at the context that there are people who didn't believe in the resurrection. Yes, sir.
Verse 19 of this chapter is, I think, as a Christian, has such a huge impact because you'll run into people that, you know, they believe in Jesus as a historical figure, but nothing more than a great teacher and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, if you really look at Christianity at the heart, if in this life only we have hope in Christ, we're all men to be most pitied. That's our entire way of thinking hinges on his resurrection. And if it didn't really happen, then we've been led astray, living our lives around a lie, and it's all for naught.
I agree. And that's what... How do you go to church? How do you partake of the Lord's Supper? What hope do you have if you don't believe that Christ was raised on the third day? You don't. All right, and then chapter 16 is more of... I'll call it a benediction, but he's kind of wrapping up the letter. All right, so having discussed what was going on in the First Corinthian letter and what was going on in the church in Corinth, what problems were the Corinthians facing?
Factions.
Idolatry.
Spiritual problems.
I'll say Jews were still ascribing to the old law as opposed to what Christ had set forth.
Immorality.
Definitely immorality. They did have problems with priorities. Obviously, when we talk about the Lord's Supper, they weren't prioritizing it the way it should be. Along with that, when I think Sam said factions, different classes of people. They're different socioeconomics in that congregation. And that if you don't view each other as Christians and value each other the same way, you look at each other as rich and poor and I have more than you have. It's too easy to split a congregation over what you have as opposed to the fact that you all have this eternal gift given if you obey God. And so you're all working towards the same goal, the same purpose.
Following through on their pledge to contribute to the needy Christians.
Yes, sir. And that's going to be a couple of chapters in 2 Corinthians. The pledge to give to needy saints. We discussed belief in the resurrection, and then false teaching, which we'll also see in the 2 Corinthian letter as well. I've got several different places in here where you can kind of see where Paul had detractors. There was false teaching going on. We discussed chapter 1 of 1 Corinthians where he's talking about the foolishness of God is wiser than is wiser than man, and the weakness of God is stronger than man. And he's sitting here having to combat man's knowledge versus God's knowledge. You look over at chapter 15, verse 33. Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. Become sober-minded as you ought and stop sinning, for some have no knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. Don't let the people inside your congregation, don't let people draw you away from God. Don't spend time with those types of people. Chapter 2. Here, and we'll see this again in the 2 Corinthian letter, but chapter 2, verse 1. And when I come to you, brethren, I do not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. The way he's wording this, verse 4, and my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit of power. Verse 5, so that your faith would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. Skip down to verse 14. But a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him and cannot be understood. They cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. But he who is spiritual appraises all things, yet he himself appraised by no one. Chapter 3, verse 18, let no man deceive himself. If any man among you thinks that he is wise in this age, he must become foolish so that he may become wise. Now, Paul here, it sounds to me like he is combating things that are being said, whether inside the church or outside the church, or the mindset, something that's being taught. We'll definitely see in the 2 Corinthian letter that there were people, there were detractors, there were false teachers who were after Paul, they were picking on Paul. They were telling the Corinthian brethren certain things about Paul. And we'll see in the latter part of the 2 Corinthian letter where he combats that. And so this is kind of the background, the idea of what is going on in this time period as we get into the 2 Corinthian letter. Next class period, we'll go over an introduction. Who wrote it? How can we have confidence in that? And we'll kind of go over an outline how this breaks down. And we'll try to get into, starting next Wednesday, try to get into the first chapter of 2 Corinthians.